From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. We call childhood our formative years for good reason. Youthful experiences can shape people for the rest of their lives. But is that especially true for people who grow up to write about childhood? How many kids' books are based on their authors' real lives? This hour, we'll talk with Pulitzer Prize winner Michael Chabon about the origins of his creativity. We'll also hear about the radical politics that have shaped many of our most beloved children's books. But first, Anthony Horowitz. He's the author of the best-selling teen super spy series, Alex Rider. Alex, as the story goes, was a normal English schoolboy until he was recruited against his will to work for British secret intelligence. That moment was captured in the 2006 film adaptation of the first Alex Rider book, Stormbreaker.
Who trained you?
Nobody trained me.
You're a first grade Dan, Alex, a black belt of karate. Who paid for the lessons?
It was my choice.
No. All your life, Ian Rider was preparing you. You speak French, German, and Japanese.
He took me on holiday.
You've been scuba diving, mountain climbing, abseiling.
They were my hobbies.
White water rafting, rifle shooting, martial arts. He was training you.
That's not how it was. You're trying to spoil everything. Please put me back in the photo booth and show me the way out.
The Alex Rider stories aren't the only books Anthony Horowitz has written. He created a humorous detective series called The Diamond Brothers and another teen suspense series called The Power of Five. Horowitz also writes for adults. He created and wrote the critically acclaimed British TV show Foyle's War and the five-part dramatic miniseries Collision. But as he told Anne Strangechamps, his special interest in children's fiction has a lot to do with his own troubled past.
Children's books were always what I most enjoyed writing. They were somehow a passion. You know, when I set out and did it, this is in the days before J.K. Rowling, the whole market was so different, and even being a children's author wasn't something one said with a great deal of pride. It was a strange thing to do, a backwater. And for the first 10 years, 10, 15 years even, I was moderately successful only. And often thought I was banging my head against a brick wall, whereas my other careers, and particularly television, were flying. And I used to think, I've got to give this up. My wife would say to me, don't do it. But then I wrote Alex Rider.
Well, some of it has to do with Alex Rider himself, your hero. By now, he must be practically a real person to you.
I know him very, very well. It sometimes depresses me to think that he's managed to grow old just 1 year and it's taken me 10 years to do the same. I'm getting old much faster than he. But yes, you know, one of the great pleasures of writing a book like the Alex Rider series is that the more I write about him, the more I get to know him and the more there is to write about him. And so I've been able to explore his past, his lack of parents. And with each book, I find out a little bit more.
Could you kind of go through his dossier for us? I mean, who is Alex and what has he accomplished so far?
Alex Rider is a 14-year-old schoolboy who finds out when his uncle dies that his uncle wasn't a bank manager, he was a spy, and who gets drawn into the world of MI6 against his will. He's a very modern kid, he's not a superhero, he's just somebody who wants to hang out with his friends, to play football, to go to school, but he finds himself being drawn time after time after time into adventures either with MI6 in England, that's the military intelligence, or with the CIA over here in America. He's been here, I think, in two or three books. So it's been a busy year for him, because one of the things I should say about Alex is that it's all been 1 year in the life. He started when he was just 14. He's now very nearly 15, and he's saved the world 8 times, and all he's got out of it is a bad school report.
Yes, poor thing. He keeps going back to school after having once again nearly saved the world, and he arrives back nearly having been killed himself, and his teachers just say, sick again, Alex.
Well, of course, he signed the Official Secrets Act, so he can't tell anybody what he's been up to, and that's part of the tension and the fun of the books, because whenever he gets back to school, there's the school secretary at the gate saying, maybe you should think about taking vitamins or eating a little more fruit, Alex, because, you know, you've missed a lot of work. And he's always having to play catch-up, extra homework as well.
So the plots often read like they're ripped straight from the headlines. How much research do you then have to do in order to write a new book?
Every single Alex Rider book takes at least 3 months of research of one sort or another, and that research involves reading books, going on the internet, talking to people who might help me, and a great deal of travel. For the new book, I went to Kenya in Africa in order to get a feel for the jungle, which is where the book finishes, and the animals and the sort of the world of crocodiles and all that. I also went to Scotland. The book climaxes with a chase to a dam, and I needed to know what a double arch curvature dam looks like, and also, of course, how to blow it up. So that meant visiting a dam, the only one I could find near me. There is one in Kenya, but it was a little too far to get to, so I went to one up in Scotland and looked at that. The book opens in a nuclear power station, and I went to that too. The point here being that what I'm doing in the Alex Rider books is escapism. It's light-hearted adventure and that, nothing more. But I think that it works if it's really grounded in reality. That's the secret of the books, I think, is to present a very, very real world in which very extraordinary and unreal events happen. But the facts, the machines, the aeroplanes, everything has to be very, very well documented, and the places too, to make the books feel real.
One of the other endless sources of delight in the books are Alex's gadgets. He's got everything from exploding zit cream to bicycle with ejector seats. Are all of these pure fiction, or are they technically feasible?
Well, I've made it a rule in the Alex Rider books never to put in a gadget that is not technically feasible, because for my mind, one of the things that has slightly damaged the James Bond movies have been some of the later gadgets, things like the invisible car, where you know it's not possible, it's ridiculous, or the watch that fires a laser beam that can cut through a wall. And that, to me, slightly undercuts the movies and the stories, because if you don't believe the gadgets, why should you believe anything else? So for the Alex Rider gadgets, the rules are very simple. First of all, they have to be something that a teenage boy might have in his pockets, and I get that simply by going into my son's bedrooms and sort of having a little scout around and seeing what happens to be lying on their desks and stuff. That's the first thing. The second thing is, as I say, they have to be completely realistic, and the third is they have to be non-lethal, because by and large, Alex doesn't set out to kill anybody, so the gadgets have to be fun, with a smile and clever rather than violent and lethal.
Well, so for example, in this book, what are some of the gadgets you've given Alex?
Well, because this book uses Alex at school quite a lot, this time Alex is back at school and is posing as a schoolboy, the gadgets are things that you would find in a pencil case. In fact, it's a Simpsons pencil case that he carries. The pencil case is itself a gadget, and everything that's inside the pencil case, each one of them is something different, although I have to say you have to read the book to find out what they are.
Remember the gel ink pens? It turns out the gel is gel ignite.
That's right. Well, I do like my little jokes, my little word plays and such. You know, my favourite gadget in all the Alex Rider books was bubble gum, that if you chewed, it could then turn into an explosive material. And I love the name of it, Bubble 07.
There are lovely little moments of homage to the James Bond film, and there are probably moments of homage to other films that I haven't really caught yet. You're somebody who grew up loving spy movies?
I did. I mean, when I was growing up, from about the age of 12 onwards, the Bond movies were coming out at that time with Sean Connery in them. And I'm glad you used the word homage, because that's what I was trying to do with Alex Rider. I was trying to remember my childhood delight in these movies, to strip them of some of the violence and the racism and of course, the sexual content, and sort of purify them, and to be close, but not ever to steal from the Bond movies. That was the rule. And again, when I'm thinking of gadgets or action sequences or anything really in the books, the first question I ask myself is, did Bond do this or have this? And if the answer is yes, then I can't use it.
You have such a strong sense of what 14-year-olds are like. Are you one of those writers with an amazing recall? Do you remember much of what you liked and were like yourself at that age?
I do have strong memories of being 13 and 14, and they're not particularly happy memories, I'm afraid, because although I had a very loving background, very kind parents, and a lot of wealth in my childhood, I didn't have a lot of emotion in it. It was a very strange one, in which I was sent away to a particularly unpleasant boarding school when I was only 8 years old. And it was only really when I was about 15 and 16, a little bit older than Alex is, that I began to find myself. And in my case, because I was a very rotund and unfit child, and because I was also in this very hostile environment, none of my memories of that age are particularly pleasant. Indeed, my first really happy memories, and it obviously ties in with what happened to me in my life, are of reading books, discovering the library and getting immersed into books that were, for me, a vast escape from life, and also telling stories. I started telling stories when I was 10 years old, you know, to other children. By the time I was 11, I was carrying a ledger around and writing my first stories and plays and novels and whatever, and poetry, all these different things. In some respect, you know, why did I become a children's author in the first place? Maybe it was to discover the sort of a happy childhood that I didn't have. I don't know, but what I don't do is I don't sort of write from the child within me, as it were. I don't believe in adults who are sort of 54 years old trying to pretend that there's still a part of them that's 14. That's not the case, but the memories are still there. Hmm.
You said that your childhood was in many ways not a happy one, and that you went to an unpleasant boarding school. Actually, I've read that it was rather worse than unpleasant.
When I was eight, I was sent to an environment where if the teachers behaved as they behave to me now, they'd all be in jail because, you know, flogging until you bled, that sort of thing, disgusting food, a regime of cruelty, people who seem to be determined to sort of psychologically destroy you for life. That was what it was like. And the funny thing is that for many, many years, thinking about my childhood at this school, Orley Farm in North London was the name of the place, I used to think to myself, look, you're exaggerating it and you're just being silly, and you should actually be very grateful because, you know, you've got a nice smart accent and you're very well read and well educated, so what are you going on about? But then I visited the school. I went there as a visiting author, and I walked into this hall, which is where I'd been as a child, and it was completely unchanged. They'd actually kept it on purpose to look like it had been. And I found myself frozen. I found myself rooted to the spot. My palms were sweating. I could feel my heart palpitating. I really, really thought I was going to faint. And I'm not somebody who is a particularly emotional person. I don't go to therapy or anything like that. I'm pretty much in control of myself and my emotions. And it was that moment, standing there, just gasping for breath like a fish out of water, that I realised that actually this school had done something to me so deep and so traumatic that it was still there, buried inside me. And it took me a few minutes to get myself together again and then to give my talk and to finish the day there and to leave again. But I'll never forget that, because it reminded me that from 8 to 13, bad things happened, and they're part of me. They're inside my writing somewhere, and I guess always will be.
I've read that bad things continued to happen to you for a while. It must have been very painful, but it reads like it could be out of a film or a book, the story of what happened to your father and the loss of your family's money.
My father was very wealthy. I, to this day, I'm not entirely sure what he did for a living, because he never told me. He was a very secretive person, very aloof. I should say that he ridiculed the notion that I would be a writer, which is something I don't understand, because I don't think he was a bad man at heart. I think he was probably quite a good man, maybe one who had been misdirected in his life in some way. But anyway, he made a great deal of money. Millions of pounds, and this is at a time when millions were, you know, you might multiply by 10 in modern terms. And then he became very ill suddenly, and he died. And he didn't tell my mother where the money was. What he'd done was he'd put it into a Swiss bank, and he had, at some stage, he'd flown to Switzerland, to Geneva or wherever, and he had taken the money out of a bank, put it into a suitcase, and carried it and put it somewhere else. But he didn't say where that somewhere else was. All he left was a black leather notebook. You're right to say this sounds like a novel. It sounds like something out of Charles Dickens. He left a black leather notebook full of clues, which were figures and names. I remember Archduke kept on coming up, the Archduke account. So my poor mother, in literally the state of a month, she went from millionaire's socialite to absolutely bankrupt, owning nothing at all. She went to Switzerland searching for the money, couldn't find it, and it had all gone, and for all I know, it's still there. But I want to just say the most important thing about this story, although I'm sad about what happened and such, and obviously it would have been nice for my mother if she could have found it, I would add that actually her life was much, much happier for the next 10 years as she went into a very little tiny cottage in North London where she lived until she unfortunately died about 10 years later. My father, when I was about 23, my mother, when I was just became a father at 33, she died. And it's a sort of a morality tale in itself, but one that I had to live through.
You've had such a remarkable childhood, and I guess I'm wondering whether your childhood gave you such an underlying sense that the world is a dangerous place, or at the very least, a very mysterious and ominous place. Is that why you're so particularly drawn to writing mysteries?
It's quite possibly that is the case, yes. I think when I began writing, which was at school, as I say, very, very young, 8 to 13, the stories were an escape from the world. Although it relates to the world, because I use, as we've been talking about, I do a lot of research and I make sure that the books are current and based on actual events. Nonetheless, I always feel that when I write a story, I'm, as it were, diving into a river, and that the water is going to carry me through the rapids, far, far away into the horizon, and that I don't need to worry about anything on the other side of the banks. All I need to do is to keep swimming and keep going with the flow, and I will survive and I'll be all right. So I think that the stories are, in many respects for me, a refuge, and it is the reason why I began writing children's books, because children's books are much purer. There is much less bric-a-brac in them. There's no sort of morality, no, well, there is, but it's not in your face. No politics, no philosophy, no excessive description, no need for huge psychology. It is pure story. And that, I guess, is what's always interested me, whether it is writing television or writing books. That's where my heart is.
Anthony Horowitz has written dozens of books for children, including the teen super spy series Alex Rider. He spoke with Anne Strangechamps about the eighth book in the series, Crocodile Tears. The music we're listening to is from the soundtrack to the 2006 film Alex Rider, Operation Stormbreaker. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's clear that some children's books are based on authors' real lives, but what about the creative process itself? Does an author's creativity begin in childhood? University of Maryland professor Ellen Handler Spitz writes about psychology and aesthetics. She took up the topic of childhood creativity in her book, The Brightening Glance. She says kids' imaginative play is critical to their creative development.
It's about playing, you know, playing with sounds, making connections. This notion of the brightening glance is that look, that glowing look on a child's face when something just is fascinating. And one metaphor begins, you know, this way, making something into something else. Even animals do it. I mean, you see a little kitten playing with a ball of yarn, and it's not a mouse, but the kitten does everything with it that you would do with a mouse. It's very innate, I think, to do these kinds of imaginative substitutions and play. And it's not, I don't think, about fostering it so much as it is just making a space for it, giving it room, psychic room and physical room and time.
It's not all that easy to know exactly how to respond to them either. There's a story that you write about, which I gather is pretty well known, about a little girl who starts talking to a mayonnaise jar. And mom gets involved. Yes. Maybe you should tell the story so that...
Yes, the story was that the little girl was in the kitchen. The mother was making her lunch, a sandwich for her lunch. And suddenly she starts to talk, but she doesn't talk to her mother. She talks to the mayonnaise jar, and she says, "Mayonnaise jar, I love you." And what happened at that point, I mean, the mother could have just said nothing and waited to see what would happen next. But this mother jumped right in and immediately took the part of the mayonnaise jar. She began to act that role. And a dialogue sprung up between the little girl and the mayonnaise jar, who was being performed, you might say, by the mother. And the little girl says, "I love you, mayonnaise jar, and I want to marry you." And the mayonnaise jar says, "Well, you can't do that. I'm actually a mommy, and I have lots of little mayonnaise jars on the shelves in the market." And then the little girl says, "Well, but, you know, I'm looking at you, Mrs. Mayonnaise Jar, and you seem to be pretty empty. What will happen to you when you're completely empty?" And the mayonnaise jar says, "Well, I don't know. It's very sad, and I think actually they're going to take me to the recycling place, and they're going to throw me, and I'm going to smash into smithereens, and then I'll be all broken." And the little girl starts to get sad, and she says, "But what will happen to you after that?" And the mayonnaise jar says, "Well, then I'm just smashed in smithereens, and I don't know what will happen to me after that." And then the little girl starts to cry. She can't eat her lunch. And then the mother immediately snaps back into being mommy again, and she puts a little girl on her lap, and they start to talk and laugh, and the boundaries of reality are restored. Actually, I was telling this story to a group of women, both of them were mothers, and one of them said something so fascinating. She said, "Isn't it interesting that when the mother took the part of the mayonnaise jar, she didn't relinquish being a mother. She called herself Mrs. Mayonnaise Jar, but really she could have been anything, but she still kind of held on a little bit to that maternal role."
I mean, more than my initial responses to it was, what in heaven's name was she thinking? But, you know, especially with if she's going to play the role, ordinarily you would think you'd provide structure. But in a way, what she did was to provide her daughter with room to tell the story herself and let it go where it would.
Right. You know, in the book I talked about this notion of co-imagination, and I think this is kind of what it was. They were creating this little playlet together, but I really would love to tell another story that's not in the book, but that also came from another reading I did. This one took place in Virginia at the Virginia Festival of the Book, and it was an amazing story that really was so much the kind of thing I was trying to write about in The Brightening Glance. It was a grandmother who told, after I did my reading, who told everybody that she and her husband had had their little 4-year-old grandson over for a sleepover, and he had been shown the video of The Wizard of Oz, and he was absolutely terrified of the witch, and he was so scared that he could not go to sleep, and they tried everything to get this little one to sleep, and nothing worked. And they finally started to do all the things that grown-ups do. They opened the closet, and they said, "Look, there's no witch in here." They opened all the drawers of the dresser under the bed, showed him that there were no witches behind the curtains of the room, and all of those things, and nothing satisfied this little one. He just was very scared that the witch was coming, and none of these adult reasons would work. And finally, this grandmother said she got it. And it was the same kind of thing. She went into the bathroom, and she took a glass, and she filled it with water, and she went right over to the little one, and she put it down next to his bedside, and she said to him, "When the witch comes, throw this water at her." And it was so wonderful, because in this moment, she entered into the imaginary world of the child, and she understood something that she hadn't understood before, which was that this witch was real to the child.
Right.
And the child relaxed, and the child was able to go to sleep with the water next to his bed. And it's this kind of thing. It's these moments when you suddenly see into this other world of childhood. And I recommend so much that one of the ways to do it is to try to remember your own childhood.
Yeah, but it's really hard, isn't it? Because,
I know.
I mean, we've spent a lifetime learning not to be that child, to deal with the real world, to deal with the world as it is, to deal with facts, to take care of things, and as a parent, to handle all of the problems that our children may face. What you're suggesting is that you have to get past that and go back. While maintaining your adulthood, you have to go back and find the space where things were real in a different way.
Yes, I think it's much harder to do it. It's hard to do it when you are a young parent and the weight of responsibility is so firmly on your shoulders. Sometimes somebody else can do it, like an uncle, as in Jacques Tati's movie Mon Oncle, where you have this little boy growing up with these very prim, proper mother who washes him constantly. He's constantly cleaning him and, you know, fixing him. And then he goes off for these wonderful, magical afternoons with this uncle who lets him do anything he wants. Or a grandparent. I wrote in Inside Picture Books about some books that tell how grandparents can somehow relax in ways. I know my own father was much more able to be silly with my children than he ever was with me. So I think that it's hard for the young parent to do this because, as you say, we're so concerned to protect the child, to be sure that the child is doing everything properly. But I do think that childhood is so brief. It enriches the experience of being a parent when you can let go of that need to control, and you can just let these moments happen and tune into them.
Ellen Handler Spitz is the author of a number of books on psychology and aesthetics. We spoke about her book, The Brightening Glance, Imagination and Childhood. Childhood and creativity are two subjects that fascinate Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Michael Chabon. Chabon is best known for his many works of fiction, including The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay and Summerland, his novel for younger readers. But in a recent book of essays called Manhood for Amateurs, Chabon takes up the topic of his own childhood. He spoke with Steve Paulson about how many of his past experiences still influence his writing, even now.
Every work of art is one half of a secret handshake, a challenge that seeks the password, a heliograph flashed from a tower window, an act of hopeless optimism in the service of bottomless longing. Every great record or novel or comic book convenes the first meeting of a fan club whose membership stands forever at one, but which maintains chapters in every city, in every cranium in the world. Art, like fandom, asserts the possibility of fellowship in a world built entirely from the materials of solitude. The novelist, the cartoonist, the songwriter knows that the gesture is doomed from the beginning, but makes it anyway, flashes his or her bit of mirror, not on the chance that the signal will be seen or understood, but as if such a chance existed.
Oh, that's great. Thank you. This passage comes from an essay on a comic book club that you tried to start as a kid, which apparently was a spectacular failure.
Did not work out too well. No, no. It was one of the great moments of sadness and disappointment in my life. It was my James Joyce Araby moment.
But it's also a fascinating commentary on what it means to be an artist, because it sounds like you're saying that whenever you write a book, you're just hoping, maybe praying a little, that readers will like it.
Absolutely. Not readers, sort of lowercase r readers, but there's an imagined fellow, an imagined partner. There's the reader who understands all of your references and gets what you're trying to do and can see how your patterns are derived from this or that source and you know, appreciate your character's sense of humor. And that's just a complete fictional construct. I mean, obviously, there is no such person, but you have to write as if there were.
Now, what you write about in this collection of essays is not just sort of your origins as an artist, but also your experience as a father. And I think a lot
Talk about failure.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, you seem to be a devoted father, the way you write about these things, but you also say that the historic standard of fatherhood is so pitifully low, at least as
yes.
compared to what mothers do. So I have to ask you, how would you assess your own success as a dad?
Well, I try. I really do try. And I guess I feel that I've been graced with a number of moments in the course of my career as a father where I got some kind of apparent sign or proof that I was doing a good job. When one of my children maybe behaved in a way that I consider to be, you know, menschlich, like stepped up to the plate and apologized when it was really hard to do so, or was thought about an older friend of the family that was, you know, in the hospital and came up independently with the idea of writing them a note to cheer them up or something like that, then, you know, you take those moments and you think maybe
you had something to do with
that. Doing an okay job, yeah. You know, yeah, like somehow some of this is getting through. But I also spend a far greater percentage of my time thinking about my kids, regretting things that I said, regretting things that I did or failed to do, wishing I had been present for something that I was not present for, regret and remorse and wanting to do better is the main currency of my nighttime thoughts about my kids.
Hmm. You have a wonderful essay about a dinner conversation you once had with your 13-year-old daughter who asked you about marijuana.
it all started so innocently with Beatles lyrics, you know, and that movie Across the Universe came out, and it kind of kindled my kids' interest in the Beatles. I mean, they had been exposed to them all their lives, and it wasn't that they didn't like them. They liked them. They listened to them. But something about that movie sort of recast it in a way that seemed appealing to kids their age. And so they were listening constantly to Beatles songs. And my daughter came out with this question about a Little Help from My Friends, when he says, "I get high with a little help from my friends." She says, "You know, Daddy, when he says that, does he mean, like, being around my friends makes me feel really good, or does he mean get high, high?" And my wife and I had spoken so many times. We had planned for this conversation. You know, my wife actually worked for a while as a drug policy reform advocate, and I just was caught completely flat-footed. This question came out of left field, and before I could, you know, think about what I was saying, I just said, "Hi, hi," and that just led somehow into this whole conversation about drugs and had I tried them and what did I know about them.
And then your son, the way you write about this, your son asked, "So how many times have you smoked marijuana?"
Yeah, finally it came to the most painful question of all. Yeah, I mean, and this is the one where parents lie, because, you know, the truth of the matter is, aside from the fact that marijuana is illegal and you can go to jail for a long time and get in a lot of trouble for doing it, apart from that, I actually don't think there's anything wrong with it at all, and I think it's actually preferable to alcohol.
And yet you also say that when your son asked you that, I mean, how many times have you smoked pot, what you were really thinking was a million times.
Exactly.
But you weren't going
to
tell
the truth. I wanted to tell the truth. You know, I wanted to say the truth, and the truth was, you know, impossible to count, innumerable. But I couldn't say that. So I just was too hard. So instead, I just said a number of times, which was not a lie.
Mm-hmm. And getting back to this
and
question
satisfied him.
Yeah, of sort of, you know, success or failure as a father, was that a good moment for you as a dad?
I guess I kind of felt more like I just slid by. There's so much hypocrisy involved in the whole question of drugs. You know, our societal hypocrisy is so acute. And hypocrisy is it's both the bane of your existence as a parent, and it's kind of your meat and potatoes, too. And I just wished there were a way that I could have talked about it without it involving so much hypocrisy.
Now, the other piece of this story, it seems to me, is that parents today are a lot more involved in micromanaging their children's lives than our parents tended to be. I mean, I spent large chunks of my adolescence just out of the house, elsewhere.
Absolutely.
And you refer to this freedom as the wilderness of childhood, which you say is now gone. The days of adventures are past, which is, I have to say, kind of a sad commentary.
What's really sad to me is not that people don't send their kids outside to play. And let's be clear what we're talking about. We're talking about, and you mentioned it, you know, get up in the morning, walk out the door, say bye, Mom, mm-hmm. and don't come back till dinner time. Mm-hmm. And your mom has no idea where you are.
Right. And who you're hanging out with.
Or who you're hanging out with or what you're doing. You know, and it just was not an issue. That's the kind of freedom I'm talking about. And what's sad to me is not just that my kids don't get that I don't let them do that, that I don't feel like it's possible somehow anymore, but that if I did, and when I do, and when we do send our children outside, there's nobody out to play with.
Right.
They're just in this, like, deserted, you know, moonscape where the children, something terrible has happened to all the children, and they've been taken away, and where are they all? And, you know, they're all inside. You know, it's just, it's not right, and I think we know it's not right, and I think it's a persistent source of guilt for parents, and it's pretty much unassuageable, and parents do all kinds of things to try to compensate for it, and I mean, I do too, but ultimately, I don't think there is any compensation. There's no substitute for that. Mm-hmm. It's just either you get it or you don't.
You have another essay called The Splendors of Crap about all the bad books and TV shows and stupid cards that you once collected, mm-hmm. you know, all the stuff that you did as a kid, mm-hmm. which may have seemed like a total waste of time, and yet in some strange way it seemed to have created an imaginative space that helped shape who you became as an artist, for one thing.
The example that I give in the piece is as of this TV show. It was a TV series based on the Planet of the Apes films. Mm-hmm. It was lousy. You know, and people, I haven't gone back to look at it, but actually I have encountered people who have, and they confirmed to me that it was pretty lousy. But it had this open-ended quality. And I guess I see that as a hallmark of the stuff that was most important to me, whether it was high-quality, approved, capital A art, or whether it was crap like the Planet of the Apes TV show, is that there was space in it. It was open-ended. There were things that you don't find out. There are things that because the show was canceled, they never got around to explaining. And it's that suggestion that there's more that is not being said, that could be said, that offers that kind of invitation to the fan to produce your own, to do your own version. It's true with Sherlock Holmes fandom as well, which was my first real fandom, I think. You know, and the reason that we've had all of this mock scholarship has cropped up and people write their own Sherlock Holmes stories is because Conan Doyle left all of these things unexplained, or he made mistakes that have to be reconciled. And it's that kind of inadvertent, often imaginative space that one finds pretty frequently in lousy art.
So when you look back on these experiences, for instance, how much you loved Planet of the Apes, did that impulse to create these imaginative worlds, did that help you become the writer you are today?
Oh, no doubt. My first impulse as a writer was to write a Sherlock Holmes story. It was to write a story about Sherlock Holmes and Watson meeting Captain Nemo from 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and teaming up with him to fight Professor Moriarty. So when I began as a writer, I began by accepting that invitation. And it was an exhilarating feeling. It's that feeling of, like, sometimes at baseball parks, they let the kids onto the field to run the bases. And it's so huge and magnificent, and the light is so remarkable, and you get to run the same base path that your gods run. That's sort of how it felt when I wrote my first Sherlock Holmes story, which was the first story that I ever wrote.
Hmm. Now, getting back to the trials and tribulations of being a parent, this also raises an interesting question that certainly I faced, which is, how much crap do you want to let your own kids watch?
Right. Yeah. There's also the question that's maybe on a little shakier ground with, which is that I feel the nature of crap, much like the nature of childhood, has also changed. Although, Harry Potter is a good counterexample, at least the books. A lot of this junk, the junk entertainment for kids, first of all, a lot of it is parody, is sort of already making fun of something else. And when something is itself a parody, I'm talking about like shows that you find on Nickelodeon or the Cartoon Network, then that there is no room. You're done. The space has already been occupied by the people doing the parody. And then a lot of it, the other stuff that you, like a lot of these CG movies, the animated films that come out almost, every few weeks now, it seems like, are so lavishly executed in terms of the stuff they pack into a scene. There's a kind of an assiduousness that maybe parallels the assiduousness with which we tend to our children and we micromanage them. In those movies, a lot of them sort of micromanage their audiences. It's not that they're worse now. It's just there's a different quality to them where there's a kind of, hey, don't worry, you just sit back and we will take care of everything for you.
Michael Chabon is the author of the autobiographical book Manhood for Amateurs. His fiction has collected numerous awards, including the 2001 Pulitzer Prize. He spoke with Steve Paulson. What do you think about childhood creativity and imagination? You can send us an email at ttbook.org. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. This hour, we're talking about how real-life experiences of writers have shaped their books. But what about an author's political beliefs, even their radical ones? Would you imagine that radical politics were behind any of these cherished stories?
One day, Danny went to the museum. He wanted to see what was inside. He saw Indians. He saw bears. He saw Eskimos. He saw guns. He saw swords. And he saw dinosaurs.
And then Harold made his bed. He got in it, and he drew up the covers. The purple crayon dropped on the floor, and Harold dropped off to sleep.
And then something went bump. How that bump made us jump. We looked. Then we saw him step in on the mat. We looked, and we saw him. The cat in the hat. And he said to us, "Why do you sit there like that? I know it is wet and the sun is not sunny, but we can have lots of good fun that is funny. I know some good games we could play," said the cat. "I know some new tricks," said the cat in the hat. "A lot of good tricks. I will show them to you. Your mother will not mind at all if I do."
Those were excerpts from Danny and the Dinosaur, Harold and the Purple Crayon, and, of course, the Cat in the Hat. So, was Dr. Seuss a revolutionary, or did he just like to mess things up? To find out, we spoke with Julia Mickenberg, who teaches American Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. She's the co-author with Philip Nell of a book called Tales for Little Rebels. Mickenberg told Steve Paulson that some of the best-known children's book writers were long-time political radicals.
People who are interested in changing the world have to be looking toward the future and are therefore interested in children. So if you go back, you know, if you go back to the abolitionist movement, there was abolitionist children's literature and socialist movement, the communist movement, the New Left. You can find educational programs and children's literature associated with all of these movements. And some of the most famous children's authors of the 20th century were involved in radical politics and often wrote for children in association with that. So, for example, Sid Hoff, the author of Danny and the Dinosaur and many other I Can Read books, was an editor at the New Pioneer, a communist children's magazine, and also did work for the New Masses.
So does Danny and the Dinosaur have a clear political message, do you think?
I've spent a long time trying to find the political message in Danny and the Dinosaur, and I have not found it. I mean, he has a kind of anarchic sensibility, Sid Hoff does, in many of his works that have just a kind of silliness, you know, suggesting that what would seem like it couldn't happen actually could. And I think you can make a case for how that is somehow political.
It would seem that that kind of anarchic sensibility would apply to another radical writer, Crockett Johnson, author of Harold and the Purple Crayon.
Yeah.
You know, this, if people remember that book, you know, Harold, who is essentially creating the world as he draws, which on the surface doesn't seem political, but I suppose it is.
Yeah. And actually, the way Philip Nell and I originally got in touch was that I knew about his research on Crockett Johnson. He's completing a biography of Crockett Johnson and Ruth Krauss, his wife, who also is a wonderful writer. Wrote books like The Carrot Seed, which is very well known, that Crockett Johnson illustrated. And Johnson also was, I think he worked on the New Masses and also did work for the New Pioneer.
Well, I mean, because there are two ways to look at this. One is that these are children's writers, some of whom have become well known over the years, and they had a history in radical politics. Maybe they were activists. Maybe they worked on various leftist publications back in the 30s, 40s, or 50s. But their children's books that they're well known for really aren't political. That was a separate thing they did. Or we could look for the actual political content in the children's books that have come down to us.
Yeah. So for my first book, I was really interested in children's books that reached a broad audience that were written by radicals. For example, many of the Golden Books were written by radical writers. Or
the Little Golden Books.
The Little Golden Books and the Giant Golden Books. I mean,
these were the things that were to help children learn to read.
Yeah. The Little Golden Books have pictures of black and white children together from really far going back. And the original I Can Read books came out of the Bank Street College of Education, which was started by Lucy Sprague Mitchell, whose books were very popular in the Soviet Union. She herself was a socialist, and she was a big proponent of these here and now books. So the idea is that children should be exposed to books that really represent their own world, and that gives them more of a feeling of control over their world and understanding how the world works. And Bank Street College of Education was also connected with Columbia Teachers College and also tied to the nursery school movement, which was seen as very socialist, the idea that mothers should be able to go to work and children would learn from a very early age some kind of collective feeling in nursery school. So they are really tied back. And also just the idea of books being 25 cents. And they were very nicely produced and affordable. And so it was a kind of books for the masses idea. And
going back to the earlier thing that you mentioned, black kids and white kids appearing in the same book, playing together. I mean, that was really, when you think about it, a radical concept. I mean, going back to the 1930s and 40s, that just – you never saw that
you didn't
in
see
the
it.
Mass media.
And another thing that I did for Learning from the Left was I interviewed – in addition to authors and editors and illustrators, I also interviewed some Red Diaper Babies. And one person I talked to mentioned the book Two is a Team by Gerald and Lorraine Byme, who wrote many, many books, very popular authors. So in the book Two is a Team, it shows a black child and a white child who are best friends, doesn't talk about race at all, and it was published in 1945. And she talked about getting that book as a gift, and she said, I knew that was a radical book, just putting those two kids in the same book. And in fact, the writer Dorothy Sterling said, and she was only half joking, if you found a book that positively portrays black people published before 1965, it was written by a communist. One of the main reasons for that was that publishers were really scared to publish anything that would kind of rock the status quo because they could lose all the Southern market. Herman and Nina Schneider were very popular science writers, and their books started selling so well that they were able to insist that they wouldn't write any more books unless they could have illustrations that would show black and white kids in the pictures.
Now, science is another interesting subject here because a lot of these radical writers really believed in the power of science and wrote science books for kids.
Yeah, there's a whole litany of explanations for this. One of the reasons that I started really looking at science was that International Publishers, which was the Communist Party publishing house, started a book series for children in 1945 called Young World Books. And this series gave the start to some of the best and most popular science writers. I was able to interview the woman who had started Young World Books, Betty Bacon. So I asked her, why did you publish so many books about science? And she looked at me like I was an idiot and said, well, to teach dialectical materialism, which I might have come up with like as like a ridiculous thing to say. But she, from a very sort of orthodox Marxist view, the idea was that if you teach children to think scientifically, they will automatically become Marxists because Marxist thinking is scientific thinking. And I did actually find books that were paraphrasing Engels. But again, if you weren't looking for this, you would never find it.
So why did a lot of these radicals focus on children? You've already said that, well, children are the future in a way. So I suppose if we can mold their minds, then, you know, we can help create the future society. But there were also economic and political pressures, weren't
there? Yeah. So, you know, one of the most exciting interviews I had was with Pete Seeger, the musician who actually, when he was blacklisted, was only able to perform for children. So I should say that this wasn't just a phenomenon of books. There was, you know, Ring Lardner Jr., when he was blacklisted, did the Robin Hood TV show for kids. I think the children's book field was relatively open and people didn't pay it much attention. It was seen to be run by little old ladies who had to be harmless, who were looking out for kids.
Now, wasn't the poet Langston Hughes also blacklisted?
Yes. He had been interested in children, had written for children already, but children's literature became one of his main sources of income. He used to go on lecture tours, and those began to be canceled, and other book contracts. And he started doing these First Books, which was a popular series. But the way that he got the job was there were two communist authors, Franklin Folsom and Mary Elting Folsom, who had done tons of First Books. And they were complaining to the publisher, Franklin Watts, that he was racist. There were no African-Americans in the First Books. And Franklin Watts said, no, of course I'm not a racist. You get me a black writer and I'll do a First Book of Negroes. So they brought him Langston Hughes. And so Hughes, at this point, was right as he was doing that, he was getting called before the House Committee on Un-American Activities, and he was really trying to prove how not radical he was. And so he wanted to write as, you know, as tame a children's book as he could. But what happened was the initial draft of his story, the editors at Franklin Watts sent it to Mary Elting Folsom to check it out. And she said, this is not doing enough to emphasize the real conditions of discrimination and segregation. And the book actually has pretty significant commentary then on discrimination. It's about a little boy who goes to visit his, in one part, he goes to visit his cousin in the South, and they say how he couldn't, you know, they had to sit in the back of the bus. And it even talks about some housing discrimination in the North. And but that wouldn't be in there if it weren't for the niggling voices of these other people.
And then there's Dr. Seuss, perhaps the most famous, one of the certainly the most famous children's book writers of the last century. Not a communist, but definitely a man of the left.
Yeah, and he had several people, including Phil Nell, have done a lot of work on Seuss and his politics. He was a cartoonist for PM, which was an anti-fascist kind of popular front newspaper, and he did lots of caricatures of Hitler and Hirohito. And then he was also what I would call an anti-communist. He made lots of drawings that were sort of mocking the whole McCarthyite investigation. And then certainly his, you know, liberal or left politics show through in so many of his books.
What about Cat in the Hat?
I've just finished co-editing the Oxford Handbook of Children's Literature, and we have an essay in there that's on the cat, relating the Cat in the Hat to this sort of 60s sensibility, even though it's published in, I think, in 1959. This sort of mockery of adults very much plays into that new left sensibility. It's an interesting essay. And then there are more obvious books. There's The Lorax, which is probably the about environmental conservation, a very clear political message. The Butter Battle book is really a condemnation of nuclear war. And then The Sneetches, it was originally about anti-Semitism, but it's really about respecting differences and all that. So yeah, I think Seuss is a very clear example of somebody who's doing work that's political, but it's also fun to read.
Then our mother came in, and she said to us two, "Did you have any fun? Tell me, what did you do?" And Sally and I did not know what to say. Should we tell her the things that went on there that day? Should we tell her about it? Now, what should we do? Well, what would you do if your mother asked you?
That was Kelsey Grammer reading from The Cat in the Hat. Steve Paulson spoke with Julia Mickenberg, co-author of the book Tales for Little Rebels. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to hear this program again, check an author's name, or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website, ttbook.org, where you can stream audio or download a podcast. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 103B, Mysteries of Childhood. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Aaron Kloon, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, Charles Monroe Kane, and Mary Lou Finnegan. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.